What is up, everybody? Welcome back to First Down Rundown, where we give you a holistic view of the world of sports. Whether you're a casual fan or an avid fan, this is the place for you. We're your two hosts. I'm Hayden Vozar. He's Matt Vozar. Today is Monday, June 3rd. It is our first time back on the pod since January 17th. So it's been almost 5 months since we've made an episode here. This is episode 19 of season 4. So we're I think we're on track. If we do, you know, one per week from here on out, or at least, or you know, two per week every now and then, we're on track to finish off like 30-ish episodes probably by the end of the summer, which is when we end off the season. So we're back officially and hopefully for good this time. I finally graduated college. It seems like forever for those of you who have been here since the start, which is probably most of our family and friends, but happy to have you back. If you're new here, welcome. This is kind of like a fresh start for us, I would say, but also not really, because Matt and I have been keeping up with the sports content on our own, and we're back here to kind of relay it to you guys. This is going to be more of a spring update, as you see in the title, so it's not really going to be a really specific episode where you're going to be hearing a lot of specific topics or content. It's really just going to be kind of an overview of a lot of the sports, including the NFL draft, which we're going to be talking about first, because that's kind of the most recent but kind of long and gone topic that we haven't gotten to touch on. And NFL is our thing. So we got college football coming up here soon, along with NFL. So obviously after the summer, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be go mode for Matt and I once football season hits again. But we're in NHL and NBA playoff season, which is nice, because these are actually, you know, some of these episodes have actually done some of the best for us in the past when we talk about NBA and NHL, which we aren't as good at talking about as the NFL, but we're going to give it our best shot here again today. So we've got Matt on the other end of the line here. Matt, how are you?
I mean, I wouldn't sell us short there, Hayden. I think we're pretty up on the news and everything when it comes to following sports of all kinds. I mean, we're gonna be talking tennis and golf in this podcast too, right?
That's right.
So yes, as Hayden mentioned, we're finally back. He basically was like, "Yeah, screw you, Matt. I'm not gonna do any podcasts. I'm super busy. So let's just not do anything until I graduate." And so, thankfully, pretty much the week after he graduated, we were like, "Hey, let's get the band back together here. We got a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of updates to get to, and as he mentioned, we're gonna kind of have a more basically try to do at least one episode every week from here on out, pretty much until kind of throughout the summer. You know, previews, NFL, college, all that type of stuff for football. But you know, obviously, until then, there's a lot of stuff to get caught up on from what's happened in the last 5 months that we haven't talked about. And so we're pretty much going to hit on every sport that's been playing, even some WNBA stuff too, for the last few months. And the only thing that we're probably not going to hit, the big thing that's happened, you know, since kind of the end of college football season and the kind of the midway through the NFL playoffs, was the NCAA ruling house settlement court case thing where, you know, it's like the schools can pay the athletes and all that stuff. That I was going to include that in this episode, and I was like, you know what, that we're good at that, and there's a lot of stuff to get through on that, and it's really groundbreaking in terms of kind of just how that's going to change the landscape for college sports in general. So we're probably going to either do kind of, you know, an episode solely dedicated to that, or at least it's going to be kind of a bigger topic on one of the future podcasts that we do. So this is kind of going to be an update of like how the actual sports have been going, and then kind of some ancillary stuff along with the big news from the NCAA a little bit later on.
Yeah, I'd honestly like to do almost like a continuation of our NCAA Doomsday series, which we did two summers ago. And in that, I mean, we'll just give a little bit of props here just to kind of preview and give a little sneak peek into what we'll be talking about with the NCAA settlement. But in that series, which was a 4-episode series, all episodes were, as usual, about an hour long, probably a little bit more each of them. So a lot of content there. And if you listen to it, you would know that we actually sort of called it a little bit in our first two episodes, the stuff that we talked about in those first two episodes of that series. We kind of called what happened last week or whatever, a week ago it was at this point. And so again, that's just kind of a little snippet into what we'll be talking about, but we kind of did call it almost 2 years ago now that we did that series, which is crazy to think about, because again, it hasn't felt like that long, but that's how long these things take. And And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the future. But I'd like to do sort of like a continuation of that series in the future. I mean, honestly, this summer, if we can, kind of like towards, you know, the middle of July where there's not really much happening. And right before our NFL and college football previews, I'd like to do something like that, which is when we did the NCAA Doomsday Series 2 summers ago when we actually did it. So without further ado, let's just get right into the content for today because we've got a lot of it. So let's get into the NFL. The NFL draft happened over a month ago at this point. I know we're kind of late on the ball here, but we're just going to give a little bit of our thoughts on it, go over our key takeaways and any developments that have happened since then. One thing that I will kind of throw out there that's been something that I've noticed this year, maybe a little bit more than past years, is the whole like signing after you get drafted. I don't know if people know that that's a thing, but like after you get drafted, you actually have to sign your contract. And there's been a couple hiccups here and there with players not signing their contract yet. Like there's still players that have yet to sign their contract with the team. And that, I mean, that has to do a lot with like agents that are just trying to get these rookies into the NFL. I mean, that's a huge thing that, that isn't talked about a lot is the work that an agent has to do, especially with a rookie. Like a lot of times if an agent has a bunch of professional players that they represent, and then they have a bunch of rookies coming into the NFL that they have to represent, they have to focus a lot of their time on the rookies because they have to kind of market their rookies as much as possible so they can get the best deal because they make a percentage of the profit of the rookie deals. So they want to try to get them drafted in the first round so they can get that first round draft pick bonus. And so, yeah, that's kind of a huge thing. But one thing that I've noticed is that a lot of these guys haven't really signed contracts, or it took them longer than usual to do so. And also the whole thing with Marvin Harrison Jr. and his Fanatics thing. I don't know if you guys heard about that, but there was like a little story that came out talking about how he kind of has beef with Fanatics at this point because he decided not to sign a contract with them in college, which is what most big college athletes do. But he did so strategically in order to make more profit off of it now. But I think now they're kind of denying his plea to sign a contract with them. And so there's kind of a bunch of beef with that. But overall, I thought it was kind of a boring draft. I think it was pretty chalk. Like the first round was pretty chalk. I do have to say that there were six QBs taken in the first round, but there were also eight offensive tackles, and that's only offensive tackles, not even offensive line. I think there was one center and then maybe one or two guards also taken in the first round. So lots of offensive tackles and lots of quarterbacks taken. That'll tell you a lot about what teams value most. Offensive tackle and quarterback are pretty much the guys that you want to go after first. Those are really the franchise game changers that you want to have on your team. So overall, yeah, again, I thought it was pretty chalk. There weren't many surprising things. I mean, I'm a Patriots fan. I thought the Patriots had a pretty decent draft. We did get an interior lineman in the first. It was like, I think over the past 4 years, we've gotten an interior lineman in the first 150 picks. So pretty much like the first, I don't know, like five rounds, we've got an interior lineman, and we just continue to draft interior linemen. And we got another guard, I think, in the third round this year. And everybody was confused, or a lot of Patriots fans were confused as to why. And I think it's kind of a testimony as to how our most recent interior linemen have fared in recent years. I think that our interior line isn't that good. So overall, I thought that I thought Javon Baker was also a great pick for the Patriots. And then obviously Drake May, he's kind of a toss up. A lot of people like him. A lot of people don't like him. I have mixed feelings about him. I don't think he's going to be another Mac Jones. I think he's better than Mac Jones, but if he's put in the same situation as Mac Jones, who knows what will happen? Because a lot of people say that Mac Jones was put in a bad situation. I think he's just kind of a dirty and bad player altogether, and he had everything given to him at Alabama. So hopefully Drake May will do better than he did, or will fare better in kind of a shaky situation that the Patriots are in right now. I don't expect them to have a really, really great season this year, just because they got Drake May and guys like Jalen Polk and Javon Baker to help him out. I don't think those guys are really going to make a huge splash right off the bat, but those guys are developmental guys that hopefully will stick with it, will be part of the system and will develop into really good players kind of a few years down the road. But overall, yeah, I mean, I couldn't really name a team that had the best draft. I know the Commanders had a pretty good draft. I'm pretty sure the Vikings had a pretty good draft too, from what I read afterwards and kind of from what I gathered from the whole draft situation. But I didn't have enough time to do a lot of draft analysis this year, and a lot of I didn't have time to watch a lot of film on the first round prospects. So I can't really give you a lot of that. And obviously we didn't do a first round episode either. I didn't do one of those episodes that I usually do with my buddy Ishan, who loves the draft more than his own family probably. So so we'll kind of keep those that deep analysis for next year. But Matt, I'm interested to see what you have to say about either the Packers or any other team that you thought had a really good draft. Anything like
I mean,
that?
I don't think anybody really cares about the Packers or the Patriots, our favorite teams, really. I was just kind of more so thinking about just general general takeaways. And I think you're right in the sense that really everything went as people thought it was going to be. And I think in this day and age of, you know, the media and reporters and agents and Twitter and everything just being so available to everybody at all times, it really makes things almost even harder to like hold behind the vest in terms of, you know, what teams are going to take who and what teams like who where. And so I think that, you know, there's definitely a sense to the draft where the information is available, and if you can find it, you can kind of get it, right? There's kind of, you know, in the betting circles, it's funny because it used to be the best, like the bettors who were tied in with the most with the teams and the agents and everything, they would make their most money of their entire year on the NFL draft and betting where guys are going to be placed and where and who's going to take them and stuff like that. And I've heard a few people say it's basically kind of not really like that anymore. Like everything's kind of out there, everything gets leaked, and that's just kind of how it is. So I feel like there probably won't, even in the coming years, there probably won't be any crazy surprises that come up in terms of, like, at least in the top like 3 or 4 to 5 picks, you know, especially when it comes to a quarterback heavy draft class like this one. And as Hayden mentioned, it's the first time that there's 5 quarterbacks in the top 10, and there was 6 quarterbacks in the top 12, and that's the most that's ever happened. And it's interesting too, because it's almost like there's not really any besides Caleb Williams, none of them are generational prospects, you know. I mean, like you have your ones throughout the years, Andrew Luck, Trevor Lawrence, you know, stuff like that, but I mean, you know, Drake May was good in college. I mean, he was better in his junior year than he was his senior year. And I know that was like offensive line stuff and whatever, but, you know, same, right. Jaden Daniels, like, amazing season, came out of nowhere, won the Heisman, like, you know, totally deserving of being a first round pick and a top one at that. But there's a lot to work on there, right? And so I think that, and JJ McCarthy, same way, like he barely even threw the ball in college at all. And now he's, you know, he's a top 10 pick in the NFL draft. But I think that with, obviously, you know, everything revolves around money these days, and we see these quarterbacks getting paid. Jalen Hurts, you know, is a perfect example where the Eagles found out that he was pretty good, right? On his rookie contract, they signed everybody in the world they possibly could. They made a Super Bowl run. They lost to the guy that everybody loses to in this day and age. And so that's kind of become the strategy now. It's like quarterback is by far and away the highest paid position in the NFL. I mean, we just saw today, Justin Jefferson just got his 4-year, $147 million deal or whatever. And it's like, you know, record breaking. Oh my God. Highest paid non-quarter. And he's like 10th on the list of like total, you know, players who are like the total salaries in the league, because the top half of all the contracts in the entire league are all quarterbacks. And so it's one of those things where you have to take advantage of these guys on their rookie contracts to be able to kind of put the pieces around them to be able to support, you know, their talents and what they could possibly give you in those early stages of their career. You know, and obviously we saw it last year with CJ Stroud, like, you know, nobody ever really had him as the first pick overall. And the Texans probably would have drafted Bryce Young if they had the first pick, but, you know, they just kind of went CJ Stroud because he was the second best available, and look what he is, right? He's arguably one of the top 10 quarterbacks in the league right now. And we saw, you know, what the Texans are doing with Stephon Diggs and getting that defense all, you know, all together. And they're going to be one of the best teams in the league this year. And so it's like, that's what can change a team so quickly. And so I understand kind of just, you kind of just have to go for that quarterback, right? I mean, the Vikings, like, they knew they had to pay Justin Jefferson. So, you know, what are we going to do? We got to draft a rookie quarterback. If he's bad, we have Sam Darnold, and it's not going to be, you know, they're in a rebuilding situation anyway. So I do kind of agree with the, you got to take a quarterback early. Now, Hayden, the only quarterback that was taken early that caused all the commotion and controversy in the world was Michael Penix Jr. It was weird in terms of the media cycle. And again, I'm not necessarily, I'm so tuned into this stuff a lot of times, and I listen to podcasts constantly, that I'm not sure how like the rest of the general public takes in all this information. But at least from my side of the table here, at first, obviously, everybody hated the pick. It was the stupidest thing ever. How could you possibly do that? You signed Kirk Cousins to, you know, $200 million guaranteed, and I don't even know how many, 4 years or whatever. And then you draft the oldest and most hurt quarterback in this draft class. And it was, you know, for the first 3 days after the draft, it was like, this team is absolutely, they've tanked their entire organization. How could they possibly do this? This is the worst move that I've ever seen. And then it's like, there's a shift. And then basically the rest of the week after the draft, to people being like, well, no, actually this does kind of make sense, because Kirk Cousins had, you know, obviously he had the Achilles last year, you know, he's out for the year. It could very easily happen again. They want to get their guy now because they believe in him for the future. Ideally, and this is kind of the biggest argument that the Falcons GM made, was, you know, ideally they're never going to be drafting in the top 10 again, or quote unquote, they won't be drafting, you know, for the foreseeable future, because Kirk Cousins will at least make their floor as kind of a playoff-esque team. And so they won't be drafting as high as this to be able to have a chance at getting a guy like Michael Penix. But obviously, right, they come out and say that ideally he doesn't play for another 4 years, and he's going to be almost 30 by that point, when, you know, CJ Stroud is 21, and he's, you know, one of the best quarterbacks in the league already. So you're giving up like 6 or 7 years on Michael Penix there. So there was a whole argument back and forth, and I saw both sides of it, but it was almost like, and I don't know whether it was people just trying to be contrarian and be like, this was actually a good move after you think about it for a little bit. So I guess, Hayden, what was your reaction? Obviously, everyone's reaction was, it was a terrible pick. I get that. But I'm talking about in terms of like how you consumed the wave of information over kind of the week. And once there was some time to kind of let everything simmer, did it seem like more people ended up kind of being positive on this deal than others? Than it was like right when it happened during the draft?
Yeah, I think that people, well, I'll first off and start by saying that there were that video that came out of the Falcons owner and the Falcons GM kind of arguing right after the pick happened. First of all, it was kind of funny. And I think that's kind of what a lot of people based a lot of their criticism off of. Like they saw that and they said to themselves, if they're arguing over this pick, obviously it must have been a bad one. And right. I mean, like right off the bat, you look at the pick, 8th overall, obviously nobody was expecting them to take Michael Penix Jr. because he is so old. And even though he's so old, like, he's still a good quarterback. And I mean, we see, my thing is, even if he hits 30 and he doesn't play a snap of football until he's 30 years old, and Kirk Cousins at that point is out of the league, retired, or kind of winding down and becomes one of those weird old backups that just kind of goes from team to team, like a Joe Flacco or, you know, Brett Favre at the end of his career, that kind of just goes from team to team and throws picks. At that point, I think Michael Penix Jr., he's still, I mean, quarterbacks play until they're, you know, 38 at this point. And that's kind of like normal, you know, in a way, if he turns out to be a good quarterback. And if he has enough training and if he backs up Kirk Cousins is probably going to turn into, you know, a pretty highly renowned quarterback or a highly respected quarterback that can, he is a vet at this point. And we all, you know, we always talk about young quarterbacks sitting behind vets. Now we're kind of seeing an old quarterback sit behind vets, or at least, you know, like an older quarterback sit behind a vet, who, if he does play out the rest of his career, Kirk Cousins does, Michael Penix Jr. gets thrown in there at 30. He could still have a good, like, 5 to 6 years. And if at that point, like Matt said, he made a good point with the whole, they don't want another, or they're, you know, they don't foresee themselves having a top 10 pick in the next 5 to 6 years or whatever it is. If they hit that small window when Michael Penix Jr., you know, in his second year in Atlanta, and he's like 32, his second year as a starter in Atlanta, if they hit that window right there and they have a really good team right then, if he brings home a Super Bowl for them, that, I mean, mission accomplished, right? Like you hope for things like that out of a pick like this. Now, is it kind of too, you know, are there too many things that have to fall into place for that to happen? Probably. And you don't really want to kind of, you know, depend on Michael Penix Jr. being game ready as soon as he's thrown in there as a starter on his first snap. You don't really want to have to depend on that. But if that's what it has to come to, then fine. And the whole get your quarterback as early as possible in the draft nowadays, that, you know, kind of like the quarterback craze that we see in the first round of the draft every year. It seems like it's, it seems like, you know, even more now in recent years, like last year, that, you know, the quarterback class really sucked and there was kind of nobody on the board to take, but there were still quarterbacks taken in the first round and, you know, teams still reached for them in the first round. About that whole thing, it's kind of weird in my opinion. It's like, it's almost like fashion trends, or it's like, you know, one team goes out and gets a young quarterback and then the next team is like, okay, well, we should go out and get a quarterback. If they're doing that, we got to go do it. Or they're, you know, they're, again, they're trading up and reaching for a quarterback that they don't really need in the first round. It's kind of just a thing to do nowadays. And if you were to tell me that you're going to take Michael Penix Jr. over guys like JJ McCarthy or Bo Nix, like those were the only two that were drafted behind him. Am I correct, Matt?
Yeah.
JJ McCarthy and Bo Nix, I would have taken Michael Penix Jr. over both of those guys. Now, again, for the situation at hand for the Falcons, that they just signed Kirk Cousins, yeah, it doesn't really make much sense from a number standpoint. But as Matt also mentioned, the idea of Kirk Cousins getting hurt again is very prevalent, and that's definitely in the forefront of the Falcons' minds. I think you should probably be questioning more why they paid him $200 million over 4 years.
Yeah.
Not, you shouldn't be questioning the draft pick. You should be questioning their contract that they gave Kirk Cousins in the first place. So, and that was also controversial when it first came out. So, I mean, I understand where people are coming from with the Michael Penix Jr. pick, but again, it shouldn't be about Michael Penix Jr. because he's not a bad quarterback at all. I think he got drafted in the order of quarterbacks that we saw. I think that he got drafted right smack where he should have. It's just that he was drafted super high, and because of the quarterback craze or the quarterback hype that all these teams get caught up in, that's just how it had to go. So I think the media, again, like, treated it like any media craze happens. Like, it just, you know, it was a really hot topic at the beginning when it first happened. And then, like you said, after a week, people were kind of like, wait, this kind of makes sense. People were also rethinking the whole Kirk Cousins contract in the first place. And that's how it should be talked about. But again, you can't really, it's kind of inevitable to have those first concerns that everybody had with the pick at hand. But yeah, I mean, I thought that the Falcons, like, they shouldn't really be worried, or as worried as, you know, they probably were when people were first criticizing them.
Yeah. And two things again, to kind of just more so support why this probably wasn't good. And again, I'm kind of mixed. I don't necessarily think it's like, you know, either way is super correct, but to kind of, and I'm kind of almost just going to give kind of counter arguments to stuff I've already said, but in terms of like the, we don't expect us to be here, you know, to be able to have a top 10 pick in the, you know, in the next few years or whatever, that's fine. But you're also essentially saying that you think that Michael Penix is the best quarterback prospect that's going to be available to be drafted for however long you have Kirk Cousins as your quarterback. That's basically what this pick is saying as well. And in that case, probably not. I mean, we're talking about kids that are seniors in high school this year are going to be drafted before Kirk Cousins' deal is basically up, right? I mean, that's the reality of the situation. And so we have no clue who is going to come down the pike and be a better quarterback potentially than Caleb. Maybe even Caleb Williams, right? And so in that case, you're hitching your wagon, you're mortgaging your entire future on this guy who, yes, is a great quarterback, had a lot of success. Not, you know, I think, again, like Hayden said, I think he was the true number four, you know, quarterback prospect in this draft. But you're hitching your wagons to that, and I understand that you know they did all the research and they have a lot more, you know, data tools and all this research and stuff that they're able to do, you know, a lot more so than the rest of us. But that's kind of my other thing with this is like, you know, right, this maybe was the year to just take a quarterback. And so if that's your argument, then it's like, did you really believe in Michael Penix that much? Or did you just need to take the best available quarterback because you didn't think that you were going to be here very long? So that's kind of that point. The other one is the whole like sit behind a current starter model that we've seen, especially the Packers utilize with both Aaron Rodgers sitting behind Brett Favre, as well as Jordan Love sitting behind then Aaron Rodgers. And it seems to work, right? I mean, as we saw, you know, Brett Favre is one of the best quarterbacks in the history of the NFL. Aaron Rodgers comes behind him and basically is even better than Brett Favre was, which is like nobody even thought would be possible. Aaron Rodgers becomes one of the best quarterbacks in the NFL history, really. They draft Jordan Love in the first round, you know, 4 years ago or whatever. He sits behind Aaron Rodgers for 2 years and you know, takes his pay cuts and does whatever he needs to do. He comes in, you know, his first season starting last year, they go 9-7 or 9-7. Yeah, 10-7. Maybe it was 10-7. I don't know. Either way. Yeah, I think it was 9-8. But get into the playoffs, win a playoff game at Dallas, who was the number two seed in the NFL. They were winning the entire game against the 49ers with a chance to go to the NFC Championship. And so that's what Jordan Love has given the Packers now. And as a Packers fan myself, like, I'm very excited about the future because of what the Packers are able to do organizationally, given how they draft their quarterbacks, how they breed them behind the current starters. But this is different. And because he's already kind of an older quarterback to begin with, but you just paid a free agent, Kirk Cousins, of this amount of guaranteed money and then drafted Michael Penix in the same year. Okay. When the Packers did the thing with Jordan Love, it was because Aaron Rodgers was already nearing the end of his contract. They weren't paying him any additional money. So yeah, they had to pay Jordan Love a first round contract, but they weren't shelling out hundreds of millions of dollars for Aaron Rodgers. They already had, and that was part of the deal. And so it's more about how you think of the finances of like why this doesn't really make sense, because yeah, now they're going to be paying Michael Penix a first round contract. And as Hayden said, some of the guys haven't even, you know, actually signed their contract yet. Mostly because they want more money. And basically every pick that you like, every like numbered draft pick that you go down the board is like an extra $1 million of a contract. So with him being the eighth overall pick, like he's making a lot more money than even, you know, the 24th picked guy or the 31st. So it that's kind of another way, like financially, it really doesn't make sense to do this whole like, oh, well, he'll sit behind our current quarterback and he'll learn the ropes and stuff. And it's like, yeah, but you also just waste, you poured a ton of money into that guy. Now you're pouring a ton of money into this guy too. Your defense kind of needs, you know, needs some work too. So it'll be interesting to see. I know we kind of went on a tangent with that, but wanted to kind of flesh it out since obviously there's been some time, you know, to kind of let this simmer, you know, over the course of the since the draft.
Yeah, that's right. All right. And then real quick, we kind of wanted to just go over the schedule release. And we've had gripes with the schedule release in the past. I know that Matt gets a little bit, or he's confused as to why everybody hypes it up so much. And then you're like, oh, my team is playing the Buccaneers on, you know, in week five. Sweet. And then it's like, cool. And then you see, you know, you always see those rankings of strength of schedule. And then you look at those and you're like, oh, okay. You know, I think it was last year. It was that the Eagles had the hardest schedule or whatever it was. I mean, they were like supposed to have the hardest schedule. Everybody looked at that and they're like, oh my gosh, dude, the Eagles, they made it to the Super Bowl and they have the hardest schedule. And so let's see if they can do it again. And then that's it. And it's like, there's not much else that you can really talk about. The one gripe that I have this year with the NFL, and it's not a bad thing I'm saying, but I'm questioning how it's going to affect home games in the NFL, but it's the international games. And there's actually week one, there's one in Sao Paulo, which is the Packers and the Eagles, to the two teams that we've talked about most recently here. But yeah, Packers and Eagles are playing in Sao Paulo in week one, and it's technically a home game for the Eagles. But when I was reading that, it was like, oh yeah, the Eagles will host the Packers in Sao Paulo, Brazil, week one. And I read that and I had to reread it and I was like, wait, they're hosting them, but it's not anywhere near Philadelphia. So my question, and if Matt has an answer, then great. If he doesn't, then we can kind of just ponder on that or kind of leave it up for debate. But it's like, you know, home field advantage in the NFL isn't as important as it is in college sports, just in general. And obviously even in the NBA, I feel like home court advantage is a lot more important just because of the proximity of the crowd to the court and, you know, how many players are on the court, everything like that. And just like the size of the stadium, it's just not as important in the NFL. And it's not nearly as important as it is in college football. Same sport, but just different level. But it's still, I think it still holds an advantage. Obviously in the playoffs, like it still definitely, you know, holds some kind of weight because they still base the playoff seeding, or like the seeding determines who gets home field advantage, because that it obviously still matters in some capacity. So my question is like, how are these international games with the increasing amount of them? Now we got like Germany, you know, Brazil is now in a new location. They're going to start some in Dublin, Ireland as well. You're still going to have a couple UK games here and there. So my question is like, how are these international games almost every week going to affect the schedules of the teams that are having essentially one less home game in their schedules.
Yeah, they're giving up a home game, that's for sure. I don't know in terms of like how they're how they're necessarily compensated for that, whether it's like I do know. You get to pick your bye week, I believe, in terms of when you want to have your bye week. If you're going to London or you're going to Germany or whatever, then you get to pick whether you have your bye week before or after that international game, which so in terms of like, right, if you're a younger team or whatever and you want to have your bye week earlier, like you can choose to have your bye week earlier, or right, otherwise if you're not playing any international games, you just get stuck with a week 12 bye and your team sucks and then it's, you know, whatever. So that's the advantage that they get. I'm not sure with the Eagles though, because it's a week one, so they can't really have their bye on obviously week two. So they might have just like the NFL might have just given them like, hey, you know, your bye week comes between weeks 8 and 12. Like choose one of those because you're giving up a home game. So that's the compensation at least. But you're right. This does and just really quick with the schedule release, we already know. I'm going to tell us. I'm going to say this for the last time. Well, no, you know what? I'm going to say this again next year because it's going to be even more hyped up and everybody's going to get all crazy about it. We already know what teams every team is playing every single year. In fact, usually years in advance too. You play your own, obviously the teams in your own division. You play each of them twice. You play three other divisions fully through. So all four teams in those divisions. And then you play two other divisions fully, you know, through the eight teams in those two divisions. Then you play three, they call them the unique three. So it's just the random other games that you get dealt. And that's already known. The only thing the schedule release does is it tells us when and where. Now, obviously, that's important in terms of like if you want to go to see a game, you want to be able to see what games are being played when. I totally understand that. But in terms of like, oh my gosh, I get to see the schedule. Yeah, you already knew what teams your team was playing. I obviously know that, you know, you're right, you get the graphic and your team posted on Twitter. You get to look through it. You get to say, oh, this is a win, you know, loss, win, loss. But I don't know. Just for me, I'm like, I already know this stuff. So anyway, the videos are funny that some of the teams, you know, come out with, and that's all well and good. Another thing that came out of this was the net rest days, right? This team has, you know, an average of 12.7 net rest days above average opponent on their schedule. And it's like, guess who had the most? And they're basically saying, no, sorry, okay, Warren Sharp, in case you can hear his head, he's like some betting analyst guy, and he's not even a betting analyst because he sucks at betting. But he's like some NFL analyst guy, and he does this whole thing. He has a podcast, he has books and whatever. Some of his research is pretty good, but he gets on all these podcasts and he goes, it's horrible what the NFL is doing to all these teams, and I can't believe that, you know, the Chiefs have to go through all of this and they have to play on Wednesday on Christmas Day. And it's like, guess who the two teams were that had the worst or like the most net rest day? And essentially, for those who don't know, net rest days is basically like when you're facing an opponent, however many more days of rest they have, given the way that they're, you know, your schedule works out with Thursday and Monday and now Christmas Day is on a Wednesday. So yes, they're going to be three games on Wednesday, Christmas Day. Given when your games are played, when the other team's games are played, and how many rest days they have more than you. Well, guess who the two teams, the worst net rest days, essentially. So they're, you know, the two teams whose opponents had a much more rest time than you know, their own teams last year. It was the Chiefs and the 49ers. And guess where that led them to? Oh, just the Super Bowl. So it's like this whole thing about, oh, well, we have to go to Germany on the week that the Jaguars get to stay in London 2 weeks in a row, which actually does end up being a pretty big advantage. But like that, like all of that kind of comes out in the wash because whatever the teams are projected to do, they're going to hit that mark. The 49ers had 11.5 win total last year. What they do, 12 wins. The Chiefs, I think, had 10 instead of 11. But it's like it doesn't really affect things because, as Hayden said, home field advantage, it's not that big of a deal, really. And especially, it used to be more. It's not even that much anymore. And also the traveling that these guys are able to, well, just in general, all teams, NBA teams and stuff too. The travel plan, like they have everything dialed to the second of when they need to be places, where they're going to get their chartered plane. They got all this stuff. All right. So people are going to make it out to be a big deal. And maybe I'm just yelling at the clouds because everybody listening to this is like, dude, who's Warren Sharp and why are you yelling? But at the end of the day, that's the type of stuff that I see, at least on my timeline, where it's like, none of this stuff really matters at the end of the day.
Yeah. And to your point, they have this, all this stuff planned to a T. there's multiple people whose full-time job is literally just to plan this kind of stuff and plan travel and make sure that stuff happens at the right time and on time. Make sure that there are, you know, hotels are booked on at, you know, for two nights instead of one. Like people have full-time jobs just doing this. So again, it's not going to matter. And the Chiefs are going to win the Super Bowl again. So, So that's also true. So we don't really need to worry about any of this. Anyway, that's kind of a joke, but also not really. But we're gonna leave you off with that and move into the NBA now. So first off, props to Matt for correctly predicting the Celtics and Mavericks to meet in the finals this year. Which was when did you do that, Matt?
It wasn't on the podcast, obviously. But and you didn't join. But ESPN does a bracket thing where you can create brackets for like your playoffs for the NHL and the NBA. You didn't join, but I did one with Dad, and we both had our brackets in there. And my bracket had the Celtics and the Mavs in the finals together. So, and I can show it to you if you want. If you don't believe me, I can show it to you.
No, I believe you. It's okay. I don't think we've ever had a false congratulatory moment on this podcast. So I'll believe you on that. But the story of the NBA Finals, we're not even going to really talk about the Celtics and the Mavericks. We will give a little finals prediction after we talk about this bigger story. But the biggest story of the NBA playoffs has been the Minnesota Timberwolves, whose rise from nowhere and fail from greatness in the span of just 1 month represents the complete reliance on recency bias from the media. That's a pretty good sentence there, Matt. But what do we make of the love/hate relationship that the Timberwolves have, that they've had? I mean, throughout the whole playoffs. And what do we think this is going to say for next season? Obviously, there's a bunch of recency bias in the media right now regarding the Timberwolves. It's kind of fading out. But right after they lost that 4-1 series against the Mavericks, people were kind of questioning if they even were meant to be there in the first place. And so Matt, I'm going to kind of hand this question over to Matt real quick, just to kind of give his first thoughts on the whole situation. Matt, what do you think about the Timberwolves? What do you think about the media and how they treat stories right off the bat and just glorify them to no end?
Yeah, I think it's wrong. I think it's unfair to the players and the teams. And I think this is kind of just a perfect encapsulation of like how everyone needs to have a take and everyone needs to get their take out first. And that's just like how things work nowadays in the sports media realm. And I think this Minnesota Timberwolves team is a perfect example of that, where, you know, towards the end of the regular season, they had the one seed for a little bit. They were doing so well. People were like, man, this team kind of came out of nowhere. Obviously, you know, 2 years ago you had the trade, where you get Rudy Gobert, and it's like, why would you get Rudy Gobert when you already have Karl-Anthony Towns? Like, you know, 2 7-footers at the same time, is that really going to work? And people kind of ridiculed them for it. They made the playoffs last year. They won a play-in game. Then they got smoked in whatever playoff series, whoever they played in the first playoff series. And so nobody really thought anything of it. Then this year, they're kind of building some consistency, right? The defense is good, which is what you wanted to see, especially after getting Rudy Gobert. They had the one seed for a little bit. They lost it. There was some crazy sequence on one of the last days of the NBA regular season where, like, all three seeds would have changed if the Nuggets hadn't lost to the Spurs as like 16 point favorites or something like that. Anyway, it ends up obviously that the Thunder get the one seed, Nuggets are the two seed, and the Timberwolves are the three seed. So you kind of start off right off the bat with the Timberwolves as this kind of, you know, sort of an underdog mentality type of team, where it's like, you know, right, they had the one seed, but nobody really thought they were actually going to do it. So they didn't, nobody really paid attention to it. You know, obviously they sweep the Suns, but then it's, oh, well, the Suns just suck because, you know, yeah, they have KD and Devin Booker and Bradley Beal, but you can't play like that together. And obviously the Suns are an absolute wreck, and that's something that's going to have to get blown up pretty soon here. But yeah, it was like, oh, well, yeah, this sucks. The Suns aren't, they're not really good. And, you know, wait till they face the Nuggets. And as we saw, it was a weird beginning to the series. Obviously, you know, the first four games, essentially both of the home games for each of the teams, every home team lost every game for the first four games. And the Timberwolves ended up, you know, winning game 7 in Denver, which is pretty crazy. And we saw, that's when we kind of first saw the anointedness of this Timberwolves team, whereas from the defensive end, you saw Rudy Gobert and his Defensive Player of the Year award, which has also been heavily criticized, come out and be able to guard Jokic, and or at least, you know, in tandem with kind of the other players that they have, and Nikhil Alexander-Walker and Naz Reid, all in there together. And they're able to beat the Nuggets. And then it's like, oh my gosh, this Timberwolves team is for real. Anthony Edwards, we saw however many times he was compared to Michael Jordan. And it's just like, why are we doing this? Because once you put them up there, once you give, Rudy Gobert the Defensive Player of the Year, Naz Reid won Sixth Man of the Year, I think Chris Finch won Coach of the Year. So it's like this entire team just swept all the awards markets, and now it's all coming true just because they beat the defending champions, when, just in case you didn't know, the last 6 years have all had a different champion in the NBA. So it's not like anybody's a juggernaut in the NBA, which is good, and we want to see parity in this league, but it just shows how good of the talent is in general, and that nobody really knows who's going to win every year. And it just because you beat the defending champions doesn't mean that they're some dynasty that's won every championship for the last, five of the last seven champions. Like when the Warriors had their dynasty, that was an actual dynasty because they won 4 of 7. Anyway, I digress. There is absolutely no way that the Timberwolves are going to be able to live up to the expectations you place on them if you give them the Defensive Player of the Year, you give them the Sixth Man of the Year, you give them the Coach of the Year, and then you say that their star player is Michael Jordan. There is no way that they're ever going to be able to succeed in your mind unless they sweep the Western Conference Finals, they sweep the finals, and then you're like, wow, okay, yeah, this team was that's what they're supposed to do. Like, they were never going to exceed these expectations. So that was kind of my thing, is like, it's insane how quickly we went from Anthony Edwards as Michael Jordan to, oh my gosh, he's never ready. Yeah, he's just 22, but he needs some time. This team, yeah, I mean, Rudy Gobert he was really good, but he can't guard Nikola Jokic. I'm like, who? Nobody can guard Nikola Jokic. What are you talking about? So, that just kind of was something that made me mad over this kind of this playoff span here. Obviously, right, they got absolutely blanked by the Mavericks. I didn't, and in my predictions, I had the Mavericks beating the Nuggets, so I didn't think, I actually had the Suns beating the Timberwolves in the first round of the playoffs. So yeah, I was very much surprised by this Timberwolves team and how good they ended up being, which was cool, and I loved it for that. You know, the Minnesota in general, like they their sports teams all kind of suck, so like it was a really good story to see throughout this playoffs. And you know, as much as I'm kind of rooting on my own teams here and kind of rooting for my bracket to come true, I would have liked to see the Timberwolves pull this out and just kind of like, you know, really announce that they were here. Because I think that no matter what, nobody's going to beat the Celtics anyway. So that's kind of my thing, was just watching kind of what happened here. And none of the games were close. They were lucky to get one in Dallas. Otherwise, it would have been two sweeps. I was really rooting for that too, rooting for both of them, both the conference finals to be sweeps, because that's actually never happened before. And even still, the last game was what, Saturday or Friday or something? So it's, or maybe even last Thursday, whatever. It's over a week between games when like the finals actually starts, which is kind of crazy. And that's, this NBA is so stupid for not letting the finals just start like a couple days after the conference finals end, but whatever. So yeah, that was kind of what I saw, at least from the media. And again, I know we've kind of talked about the media a lot, but it's just kind of like, at least since we're talking about these things in the past tense, it's kind of like what we saw of them and what we heard of them, what I heard of them on podcasts and stuff. And so I'm kind of just letting out my grievances more so, but I do think that like, it was a great story. They're a great team. They're going to be back. They're, you know, the core is there. The players are there. They're all good. They all work together really well. And yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, like sometimes you can't really beat Luka. Like that's just kind of how it happens. And Luka and Kyrie, for whatever reason, like have made this thing work. I actually remember, Hayden, us talking about that trade on the podcast. And like, I think you were pretty high on it. And I was like, this doesn't make sense. Two ball dominant point guards, like whatever. And you're like, hey, maybe it works. Maybe they find out a way to work together. And it's like a revelation. Like they are like brothers, like legit. Like they're like, they're like, they know exactly what each other's going to do on any given play. They work together so well on the court, which I thought wasn't going to be a thing. So, so I guess props to you for that take like 2 years ago at this point. And it's funny, cause right now that's coming true. The Rudy Gobert trade just kind of came true too. One more quick thing too. It was really awesome because the guy, and I forget his name, the GM of the Timberwolves, who's currently the GM of Timberwolves, was the guy who built like the core of essentially what's there in Denver right now. So it was kind of funny because he built the Nuggets team for what it is right now. They had a couple playoffs runs, didn't really do anything. And then he got hired over the Timberwolves. Then the Nuggets won their championship with the team that he built. And then he basically built the Timberwolves to be able to beat the Nuggets because he was like, oh shoot, I built a juggernaut. So now I got to build this team to beat the Nuggets. And props to him. He pulled off the Rudy Gobert trade and look what happened. They beat the Nuggets in the playoffs. So I thought that was a pretty cool story too.
Yeah, for sure. I didn't even really know about that, but very cool observation there, Matt. And yes, props to me for liking that Kyrie trade to Dallas, because I did I did like that trade back when it happened, way back when, and it is working out now. So give myself a little pat on the back for that. The one thing that I will say about regarding this whole situation and the Timberwolves and how the media glorified it and everything, I think that Anthony Edwards in the press conference after Game five, when they officially were kicked out of the playoffs by the Mavericks, I think that he kind of said it best. His response to one reporter was a reporter said something, I can't remember exactly what he asked, but it was something like he told Anthony Edwards to rank this loss, or like rank getting kicked out of the playoffs this year, losing 4-1 in in the Western Conference Finals. He told Anthony Edwards to rank that on a scale of like all of the hardships that he's ever faced. And Anthony Edwards basically sat there and he was like, it doesn't even really rank. He was like, I've gone through a lot of hard stuff and this doesn't even really hold a candle to anything that I've gone through, which is a great answer. Like, I thought that that was
Yeah, I love
awesome. Cause
that.
then, cause again, like it points out how, right, this means a lot to these guys, but these guys, at the end of the day, these guys are getting paid millions and millions of dollars. Anthony Edwards, like Matt said, was getting compared to Michael Jordan the whole entire time throughout the playoffs. And now people are kind of like, biting their tongues, like, oh, well, maybe not, because he didn't, he's probably not going to win, six NBA finals in his career and go 6-0 in the finals like Michael Jordan did. So, right, like the media just needs to slow down every once in a while, and reporters need to be smarter with what they say. I know that a lot of reporters don't actually mean their questions, and they're just saying them because they have to, and it's their job, and it's really somebody else, like a news outlet that's writing up these questions for the reporters to say, and they're kind of just the puppets that the news outlets are using to get their content. But it's like athletes, like even though Anthony Edwards is young and he, you're probably going to get a whack answer out of him every once in a while. It's like he's not that stupid to rank this hardship as one of the highest that he's ever gone through. Because again, yeah, he's, most people have gone through a lot harder things than getting kicked out of the Western Conference Finals in the NBA when you're making millions of dollars every year. So I think that Anthony
And he's,
Edwards handled that perfectly. What'd you
yeah, and
say?
he's 22. And so
Yeah.
it's like I mean, Michael Jordan at this point was still in college. So
Yeah.
in my mind, Anthony Edwards has all the time in the world to be able to do, obviously, yes, as you're right, Aiden. He's not going to get to six NBA finals. He's not going to go 6-0. That's a given. And I think more so what people were saying was like the way he plays. So his shot, hit like just getting open, providing for his teammates reminds them of Michael Jordan. That's fine. But still, when you say the name Michael Jordan, you end up comparing people because it was the same thing
Yeah.
for LeBron. And LeBron still hasn't lived up to the amount of championships and whatever that Jordan did either. So like, and I can guarantee you right now, Anthony Edwards is not going to be as good as LeBron either. So it's like this is completely out of nowhere. And so when you say that, someone's game reminds you of a person, that's fine. But yeah, in terms of the accolades and everything, like that's not going to happen. And he's still so young that it's like, right, Michael Jordan hadn't even started his NBA career by now, and Anthony Edwards already has 3 years in and is the star of his team.
Yeah, exactly. So I think we're both in agreement about the whole media hyping it up. And they just need, again, it's like it goes too far when you compare somebody like Anthony Edwards, who's so young, to the best player to ever touch a basketball court. So that's kind of that. And we'll monitor this media craze, or this media, I guess, glorification, as it happens, because it's definitely going to happen again, and it's probably going to get worse. But we're here to kind of criticize it. So, with that being said, just a little finals prediction here from Matt and I. I mean, Matt kind of said it already. Like, I can't really see the Celtics losing either. They've lost one game, right, throughout the whole playoffs so
Two,
far.
but yeah.
Two, yeah, two games. So obviously they're gonna, they're gonna be really, really hard to beat for the Mavericks. The Mavericks look good, and as much as Luka and Kyrie look like one of the best backcourts we've ever seen in the NBA, I don't know if they're going to be able to do it, because the Celtics have had one of the best backcourts in the NBA for so long, pretty much, while Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown have been there together. And honestly, now that Derek White is just splashing threes left and right, like they're really tough to beat, and they've had such a good team for such a long time, and they're kind of due for an NBA Finals win. At least they made it to the NBA Finals last year. came up short. And so I think this year they're finally going to be able to do it again. It's kind of destiny at this point. And as much as destiny has been proven wrong in the past in sports, I think it's kind of going to work out for the Celtics here. So give me the Celtics. I think that they'll probably do it within six, I would have to guess. So I think my guess is going to be six games that they do it in.
Yeah, I'll probably even say Celtics in five. This is not even an evenly matched series. I mean, if you were to draft like players from both teams, you'd obviously have Luka probably first, but like five of the top seven are probably Celtics players, and that, I mean, that's just unmatched talent. Like obviously PJ Washington and Daniel Gafford have been great additions for this Mavs team that has, you know, right, ascended throughout the, you know, the end of the regular season, and then obviously throughout the playoffs, you know with all the wins and everything that they've, but like, that's, it's just, it, there's, it's, the Celtics are another planet. And I understand that, you know, a lot of that, we could also have talked about this, Hayden, the whole media thing around the Celtics, where it's like, oh, they, you know, they almost lost two games to the Pacers. How does this team continue to choke? And it's like, dude, they went 12-2 in the playoffs. They had some, I saw a bunch of stats that were basically like, that's only ever happened however many times in NBA history. Like, and the fact that they're winning these close games is better because it shows that they're actually able to do this and close out the games when they need to. So, yeah, this is a very much, is, I think it's a lopsided matchup in favor of the Celtics for sure. And like the other thing is, they went 12-2 in the playoffs and didn't even have their, you could maybe argue second best player, at least in the regular season, contributor wise, was Kristaps Porzingis. He's been hurt the whole playoff so far, and they haven't needed him. And they didn't play him on purpose because they're like, we know we're going to get to the finals. And so they went 12-2 in the East. And obviously, yes, they played the Heat without Jimmy Butler. You played the Cavs without Donovan Mitchell for, I think, the second half of the series. You played the Pacers and Tyrese Halliburton was out for a couple games too. So yes, they have had probably one of the easiest roads to the finals. And that's what people are saying is like, right, you have the easiest road to the final. You should be sweeping every team. Well, that just never happens. So you can't hold them to that standard. And so I think that, you know, they've shown what they need to show. It's just, and they've been here, as Hayden said, they've been here before. I think they, what is it, like three out of the last five now or something? Eastern, or
yeah,
they,
something like
the
that.
Celtics have been to the finals, or maybe four or six. And so, yeah, obviously, usually the Western Conference team is the one that's been dominant all year, but the Celtics team is really different on so many levels. And I think it's almost like, I think, yes, they shoot the most threes in the league, and that's just kind of like an inevitable, like, that's just kind of like an accepted fact by now. But their defense is great. And they, and because every one of their players can guard every one of the other team's players. Like, it's not, obviously on most teams you have like your catch and shoot guys who are 3-point specialists, or your ball dominant point guards who just need it, like, kind of, you know, like a Trae Young, right, is like going to score a ton. He's going to get a lot of assists, but he is horrible at guarding. The Celtics are not like that. It's like every single player on their team is a contributor offensively and a hard and good defender. So I think that's going to be the difference here, as we see the Mavs kind of come up against these teams. So yes, the Timberwolves have a great defense, but I mean, right, when Lucas and Kyrie are getting 30 a night by themselves, like, that's just not the way that the Timberwolves were built, was to guard a team like Denver and not a team like this, like the Mavericks. And I would argue that the Celtics are just a better version of the Mavericks with all their players being able to contribute offensive, defensively. So I'm going to say Celtics in five. I don't think this is going to be a very particularly close series. Maybe the NBA tries to draw it out a little bit for some ratings, but yeah, I think the Mavericks are kind of coming in here a little full of themselves. And I think the Celtics are ready to prove it for once, but then again, right, they've been here however many times and haven't actually done it yet. So we'll see.
Alrighty, moving into the NHL. So far, this year's playoffs, I'll have you know, have seen 41 games be decided by one goal or less, making it the highest total of close games since the 2017 playoffs. What do we think of this year's playoff hockey compared to past years? I'm going to just kind of start off, and this will be kind of a brief topic, and then we're going to have a little topic on the Oilers in specific, and then we'll move on to our rundown. But I think, I mean, I haven't gotten to watch as much hockey, playoff hockey this year as I did last year. But I mean, we've kind of seen the same kind of stories happen. Like the Leafs got knocked out early on again this year, which has happened, I think, the past 3 years. It happened. I mean, it never fails. It's just what the Leafs do, and the Leafs have, I mean, they're pretty comparable to a team like the Oilers, who just have like really crazy forwards. And play really well. And, you know, the Oilers have kind of struggled in the past in the playoffs, or as, you know, as of recently. And this year, look where they're at. We'll talk about them a little bit, like I said. But I think overall, like, it was cool to see the Stars at the top this year, too. Like, that's kind of a team that you don't really see that often. The Panthers, like, they are a team that, you know, that's been kind of like on and off the grid in past years. They had that one, I think it was last year, where they got to the Stanley Cup Finals. They didn't end up winning it, but it was last year when they got to the Stanley Cup Finals, and they were basically one game away from not even making the playoffs. And here they are, you know, they were one seed this year because they were really dominant, which was, I guess, not really surprising with the team that they have. But, like, yeah, I mean, you just got to see a couple of different teams, you know, at the top this year, and some of the same stories from past years. It kind of sucks to see a team like the Leafs leave the playoffs so early. Like, I'm like, one thing that I've always wondered for the past 3 years, like I've said, is, like, what if the Leafs actually made a run in the playoffs? And like, what if they were actually, you know, a team that lasted in the playoffs? What would the rest of the playoff field look like? Like, what, you know, would there be much of a, obviously there'd be one different team later on in the game, you know, later on in the field, but, like, would we have a different finals? Like, you know, if the Leafs could actually get past the first round of the playoffs, would they make it to the finals? That's something that I've kind of wondered for the past couple of years. But I think that this year, we've seen some really good hockey, and it's just like, I mean, it seems like every game is just a battle to the death, which I that's what I love about playoff hockey. Like, that's one thing that you don't really get in the regular season, and it's a lot more amplified in the playoffs. And I think there was one guy, Brad Marchand. It was when the Bruins were still in the playoffs. But yeah, he was interviewing with somebody, and somebody asked about, like, the aggressiveness in playoff hockey and how that's kind of amplified from the regular season. And he literally said, I mean, he's known as being one of the more dirty players in the NHL, but he literally said, he was like, yeah, one of the goals in playoff hockey is to hurt players on the opposite team. Like, he just said it outright. And it's like, that, I kind of like that. I also kind of don't, because it's like a little bit, it's a little bit dark, but also it's like, yeah, dude, like, heck yeah, I'm going to watch these guys go at it and, you know, throw each other over the boards and fight. Actually, there's actually that's one thing that you don't really see a lot in playoff hockey is fights, because people don't want to get suspended for coming games, which is kind of interesting. But yeah, but, like, minus the fights, or minus the lack of fights, there's just more aggressiveness all around in playoff hockey, and it's great to see. I like it more than watching NBA playoffs. Like, I always say that I watch more of the NBA during the playoffs. It's true for both the NHL and NBA for me, but I, like, it's even more amplified for the NHL, just because it's just, like, so captivating, because there's always something happening. And so, yeah, I think it's been a really great playoffs. I would rank it probably higher than last year, or even the year before. You know, obviously, like the Lightning is a team that kind of wasn't able to do it this year, but they've kind of had their shine in the 2020s so far. So, Matt, I'm interested to see what you have to say about the playoff field in general.
Yeah, I think the coolest part to me, and I think, again, all your stuff that you said was very true. The coolest part to me has been how so many series, particularly in the West, have looked like one team is absolutely dominating through three games, and then the other team just comes back and wins it. So, like, for example, the Stars, and they actually had kind of two of these where, and they were on opposite ends of it. So, like, they were the one seed. So they played the Golden Knights in their first round matchup, and they lost. And they played two of the first two games. They played them both at home. They lost both of those games. So they were down 0-2, and they come back and win four straight. Or no, they lost. Sorry, they won three. They won four of five. Because they got to a game seven. They won the game seven. But yeah, so it's like they won four out of five games to be able to take the series against the Golden Knights. Then they go up against the in this past series against the Oilers. They're up 2-1 in the series, and I think they were up 2-1 in game four, or 2-0 in game four. And yeah. And the Oilers come back and they win three straight games and they take the series. Even on the Eastern Conference Finals, the same thing. It was the Rangers were up 2-1 and the Panthers won three straight games. So that was kind of the cool part about the playoffs to me, was like, it look, and the betting odds were even crazy to watch, because it's like, I think at one point the Stars were favored against the Oilers. The Stars were favored to like minus like 275 to win the series, and it's like that didn't end up being close in the end of it, because it didn't even go to a game seven. So that's the, and that's always the craziest part about the NHL too, is like in the NBA you kind of get a feel for like what teams are going to win. It's not usually by seed, because especially now with how long the NBA season is and the rest games and all that, it's like, okay, you can kind of tell like who's going to win based on how good the teams are during the regular season, what they're able to show, and their star power. The West of this year was good to watch in terms of like, you didn't really know who was going to win, but it was like, we could have told you the Celtics were going to get through the East, right? Whereas with hockey, you really never know. And the Rangers, you know, they won the President's Cup. They looked like the best team in the playoffs. I don't think they lost a game until like the more than halfway through their, the second round of the playoffs. So that was kind of one of those things where it really, and I think Hayden's right, is like that the in-game intensity, the every player just trying their absolute hardest, the close games, as Hayden said, kind of, decided by one goal, that almost is also symbolized in the way that the series just, kind of the series trend overall, where it's like you think one thing's going to happen, then the complete opposite happens for the next however many games over games. And so that's been the coolest thing, I think, to me in the playoffs this year. I am kind of on the same wavelength as Hayden. I didn't watch as much this year as I did last year. I had it on like the YouTube TV side by side, which I'm really glad that they were able to like move that over from March Madness. Anybody who has YouTube TV will know exactly what I'm talking about. So you can watch two games at once. But I always found myself, and I was like mad at myself, I always found myself watching the NBA game instead of the hockey game, because I'm like, it's so much more like, there's just, everybody's talking about it, everybody's betting on it, so there's like so much more, I think, just coverage on the NBA that you're like, I want to see these crazy plays, I want to see these, the best players do the craziest stuff, whereas I'm like, dude, the hockey games are just way more intense, and they're like better to watch and better entertainment overall. So I was thoroughly enjoyed by this year's NHL playoffs, and obviously it's going to be a great series, coming up with the Oilers and the Panthers. It's the furthest distance between two teams, like miles wise, and NHL playoffs, or sorry, Stanley Conference Final history. So there's never, because it's like, what, I don't even know where the Panthers are, like Orlando or something. And then then Edmonton is like all the way, it's like above Seattle. So it's like they're it's like the furthest distance that they've ever traveled, which will be interesting too. But yeah, so like I think the Panthers will win. The betting odds suggest that they're favored, but right, I mean, the Oilers showed us that against a team like the Stars that looked pretty unbeatable throughout most of the playoffs, the Oilers just kind of, they sat down, they finally got their, Skinner, their goaltender, finally kind of came alive in the second part of that series. And obviously Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl have been scoring goals like maniacs. So I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Oilers win, but I'm going to pick the Panthers because, again, they've been here, right? Like 2 years, and I think you were kind of getting at this. 2 years ago, the Panthers won the President's Cup trophy, which, is the most points in the regular season. They had the best record, all that stuff. And they got bounced in the first round. Last year was the opposite, where, as you said, they barely got into the playoffs. So they were really not supposed to get in the playoffs. They had like the Pittsburgh Penguins lost like three games in a row to end the season. That's the only reason the Panthers even made it to the playoffs. They beat the Bruins in the first round. And the Bruins last year had broke the record for the best regular season ever by a hockey team in NHL history. And the Panthers are down 3-1 in that series. And they come back to win, they come back to win that series and they make it to the finals. They lose to Golden Knights. So I think it's the Panthers' time. They've had kind of these, the opposite stories the last 2 years, but I think they've been here. They know what it is. And I think they'll be able to get it done.
Yeah. I'm actually going to go opposite with you here. I think that, yeah, the Panthers, like they definitely deserve it, but I'm going to go opposite with you here and pick the Oilers. And just to kind of transition into my talk about them, Oilers are another team that just hasn't really been like that. They just haven't really been good in the past. And then in the playoffs specifically, they haven't really lived up to expectations. Obviously they've been a good team. They've made the playoffs consistently for the past few years, but they haven't really been able to get it done. Looked a lot like the Leafs in recent years. This happens because a lot of people look at their team and they see their forwards. You just see their team in general. You got Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl, Zach Hyman, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins. Like Nugent-Hopkins, he's kind of like a up and coming guy. He hasn't really been that good over the past couple of seasons, but like this playoffs, he's been really good. He had what was it? I think it was a hat trick, or no? It was, he had like the first two goals in the game six against the game five against the Stars. that led to their, you know, final game where they beat the Stars to make the Stanley Cup final. It's like, he's been really good this playoffs too. And so everybody looks at this team and every year they're like, how are they losing? They have one of the best players, if not the best player in all of hockey. And then they have a tandem of other really, really good players who have proved that they're really, really good. And they just can't really do much in the playoffs. And it's the same story with the Maple Leafs. Like I've said, I think this year the difference a lot of times is the goalie in hockey. And Stuart Skinner has actually been really, really good this playoffs. Like it's actually kind of funny because like in past years, he's just been, I mean, everybody has just absolutely crapped on this guy for being the reason why they're losing, because he kind of has been. Like his goalie percentage save over the past couple of years has just not really been that good. He's a lot of times he's actually been pulled from games because he's been so bad. They've kind of toyed, you know, played around with a couple other goalies, tried them in, you know, every now and then they'll kind of pull out Stuart Skinner, but he kind of always seems to come back and be their rock. But again, he just hasn't really been able to perform, especially in the playoffs. And this year he was finally able to perform throughout the playoffs. I think he's had like over the past two series, I think he's had like a 91 or 92% save percentage, which is a lot higher than his career. I mean, his career is like 87 or 88%. So it's a huge difference. And I mean, obviously that's only 4 to 5% from the rest of his career, but percentage wise for a goalie, that's huge. Like that, I mean, you're talking pretty astronomical numbers there in terms of difference. So Stuart Skinner, props to him for actually being good this year and actually carrying his weight. Again, the rest of the team is doing their thing, and so they're helping him out a lot. But he's been a really big difference maker. He's come up with a couple huge saves. He had one in that game five against the Stars to kind of, you know, solidify their win there. So when the Stars were kind of coming back and they had six men on the ice, they pulled their goalie at the end of the game. They had, I think it was like 3-1, and they could have made it 3-2 easily. They had like this really cool play in front of the net which it should have been a for sure goal, but Stuart Skinner made the save and saved that comeback that the Stars were leading. So huge props to him for being good this playoffs. And I honestly think they'll be able to get it done if he continues to play like this. Now, if he returns to his old self and is not saving a lot of goals, then obviously the Panthers will probably take it, because they've got Bobrovsky in goal and he's pretty good. I mean, he's tenured. So we'll see how that goes. But moving on to our last topic of the day, which is quick rundown. We've got four topics. So Caitlin Clark, our first topic here. We can't really go this podcast without mentioning her. I mean, it's been one of the biggest stories over the past couple months when she broke the all-time NCAA scoring record. Then she led Iowa to the Final Four and eventual national championship for their second loss in a row, or like second 2 years, made it to the national championship, lost both times. So a little bit sad for her, but she's also started 0-6 with the Fever this year. And then now she's taking criticism from the media and other WNBA players for being quote unquote too soft and her performance not living up to expectations. Matt, I'm going to ask you here, are these expectations, these lofty expectations, are they a little bit too high for her, or are we just seeing a little bit of hate for her coming in and kind of being the face of the WNBA without even playing a game?
Yeah, I think that's probably the key is that, you know, this is a very big step up in talent. And I think if anything, this has showed, and again, here we are, me and Hayden, you know, Matt and Hayden Vozar are talking about the WNBA on a podcast, right? Yeah. Like, this is good for the game, whether, and again, I'm not I've seen the WNBA before. I'm aware of who wins the championships. Like, I know the Aces have won two in a row and like, they're really good. And I know a lot of, you end up kind of knowing a lot of the players on the team because they've kind of gotten hype before, but it's almost like whoever wins the championship, that's like, everybody only cares about them. And it's not like any other players in the league. And then obviously with this draft class coming out of college from this year has changed everything. I mean, Cameron Brink and Angel Reese and like all the women who are now playing in the WNBA, I think has extremely skyrocketed the, you know, the notoriety of the game. And I think it's good for the game to be able to be talked about like this, but you know, it's tough because it's one of those things where it's like, obviously, right. People want the sport to become bigger. You're right. You got to make it fair. Like, the players need to be paid more. I get all that stuff. But once it becomes mainstream, there's good, like, stuff like this is going to come up. And so that's why I almost want to caution people from just kind of going along with whatever you see that's put out there, because there's always going to, people are going to hate on everything. I mean, look at Rudy Gobert, look at Anthony Edwards. Like, over the past week, those guys have been berated by the media, by other players, but we take it for granted because it just happens all the time to everyone. And it's like, as soon as anyone says one bad thing about Caitlin Clark because she's not performing as well as we thought she would, it's like, well, how could you be so unfair? And she, you know, she doesn't deserve any of this. It's like, you guys are doing it to yourself. Everyone who is talking about the WNBA ends up doing this to themselves in terms of just like putting the expectations on her, then just trashing her because she's not living up to those expectations. She was never going to anyway. And to take it a step further, I think there's like 18 teams. This is also bad for me not knowing. Hayden, we'll become WNBA experts. No, don't you worry.
Yeah,
I don't know how many teams are in the WNBA. So if you can look that up really quick, that's fine. But what I'm trying to say is that there's 30 NBA teams and there's 430 total players in the NBA, like, on any given season, right? And so you always kind of have to say, like, that's kind of the magic number of, like, there's the players in the NBA are the 430 best basketball players in the world, because everybody from around the world are going to come to the U.S. to play basketball anyway. So now you move to the WNBA, where obviously there's less collegiate women's basketball teams, but there's far less WNBA teams as a percentage and a ratio compared to how many, you know, women's college basketball programs there are. And so that's like the competition step up that we're talking about here. And I think it's good. I think this is kind of exactly what the WNBA needed for, in terms of its notoriety and everything, is for Caitlin Clark not to be good, because that's a talking point in and of itself, but it also shows that the level of competition is extremely high, and to really start to respect everybody else who plays in the league as well, that like this white girl from Iowa can't just show up and start raining threes in your head. She has been doing that. So yeah, she's still a really good scorer, but like, she's unathletic on defense. And we knew that she couldn't really guard because that's kind of how it was in college. But obviously her offensive prowess like makes her, you know, a vital, or a critical piece to have on the floor at all times. But yeah, so that's kind of my thing with the whole Caitlin Clark thing, is like, I'm not mad that people are giving her these lofty expectations. It's obviously, to a certain point, like, you can't trash on her too much, but it happens to every other guy in every other sport too. And so that's kind of where it's like, okay, well, if we need to be treating the WNBA as equal to the men's sports, then kind of the criticism that comes along with that should also be equal, in the sense of like, you have to be able to kind of take it and give it, and we kind of have to forget about it. But I think that also it's done a really good job of really promoting the other players in the sport who are way better than Caitlin Clark. And that's for sure.
Yeah. There's 12 teams in the NBA. I mean, in the WNBA, to put it in perspective. So it's literally less than half of the percentage that's going from, I mean, obviously you have international players, more international players now, and G League players that are going to the NBA, especially in the draft, like high in the draft nowadays. But I mean, a lot of these players that are getting drafted, the majority are players from college basketball. So you're looking at pretty much less than half, or just around half, the amount of women college basketball players that are going into the WNBA as men, which is insane, because there's already obviously very limited spots in the NBA. And you only have like a 1% chance of making it to the NBA, even from college basketball. So very, very good point there by Matt. And yeah, I'll just come out and say it. Like, I think WNBA players in particular are mad that Caitlin Clark is garnering all the attention and all the media space. And yeah, I guess.
While not being as good as them. Like, I totally get that.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Right. I do too. But also, the amount of sold out arenas that she's already gotten for the WNBA and the Fever in particular, like, that's going to go a long way to future contracts for WNBA players who have always complained about not getting enough money. But like, now that she's garnering so much attention, and now that there's actually fans of the WNBA, or I guess fans, quote unquote fans, that have started liking the WNBA this year, now that that's happening, like, there's going to be a lot more money in the pool that's going to go out to pay these players more. So they're going to benefit from it in the future. It's just that right now they're mad about it because it's not really going their way in attention wise. So I guess I kind of get it, but also like simmer down a little bit. It's going to come your way soon. So
yeah, that's a good point.
That'll be that. So next topic here is NCAA football 25. That's right. Video games. We're talking about on the podcast is releasing on July 19th. And boy, are we excited. It seems like the media has just been coming out with new things like trailers and gameplay almost every day at this point. So let's give a little tribute to kick off the first down rundown summer here, because that's a very big thing that's happening this summer for both Matt and I. I'm going to hand it off to Matt first because this guy's an NCAA football maniac. So go ahead, Matt. How excited are you? Just explain.
This is going to sound crazy to you, Hayden. I've dove in. I've watched all the videos. I've watched all the deep dives. I've watched my favorite YouTubers go over those details again a second time. It's going to be great. I'm going to play it. I'm going to love it. And it's not like Madden. And that's the one thing that I wanted to make sure it wasn't going to be like Madden. The player models are a little like Madden, but that's because they had to use that based on like the generation of console that they're on. I get all that stuff. But I don't know. It's starting to seem almost a little too complicated. And maybe that's just me being like going back to my glory days of like sitting in my dorm room in college during COVID, just like grinding through dynasty mode and just like listening to podcasts and trying to pay attention to that and just mindlessly playing offense only on football games and just like dominating the recruit and just having the like. It was almost to where I made it too easy for myself. And so now I'm like, oh, well, there seems to be a lot of depth to this game, so I'm not going to like it. That's where I'm at like right now. But that's also just because I'm like, I've just, let's put it this way. The last game that came out was NCAA 2014. I've been playing that game for 10 years now. So like, there's going to be some growing pains. There's going to be something, you know, yeah, different with this game that I'm going to have to get used to. And I'm fine with that. It's just going to probably take a little bit longer than I would want it to. And that's kind of where my only thing is that's holding me up, but it's going to be better. I mean, there's a transfer portal. There's not necessarily NIL, but they're calling it brand strategy or something to where it's like basically NIL, but you just can't like actually pay the players for it. Yeah, I mean, all the teams are in the game. It's going to be, I'm so excited. I am so excited. There's just kind of that one caveat that's in my back of my mind where I'm like, am I going to have to sit down for like 8 hours to try to figure out how to play this game, which I don't really want to do, but at the same time, I know that they're going to make it worth it and that it's going to be like that. And it's going to be worth it in the end for me. So I'm going to take it in stride.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a complicated game, but it's going to be so awesome. And there's going to be so many people playing and, yeah, I mean, I can't wait. And it also, like, dude, you get to play with guys that, like, you know, I mean, if you're in college, like, think about this. If you're in college and you go to, you know, if you're lucky enough to go to, like, LSU or something, and you're lucky enough to know one of the guys who plays football at LSU, and you're, you know, you just happen to have, like, a class with a football player, like, dude, you're going to be able to go home to your dorm room later that day and, like, and play football with him on a video game. Use him to play football in a video game. Like that's so cool. And he's like, his name is going to be on there and he's going to have like his own, I mean, the really good players have their own like movements and everything tailored to how they actually throw. Like I think they're going to have that too, tailored throwing movements, which they have in Madden. Now they're going to have that for, you know, Quinn Ewers. Like it's going to be, I don't know. It's going to be great. So really excited for it too. I haven't played NCAA 14 as much as Matt recently. I used to play it a lot when I had it, but then Matt took the Xbox 360, rightfully so, because I was in college and I didn't really have much time to play it. But now that there will actually be a game out on Xbox One, which I still have the Xbox One, I probably need to upgrade at some point soon, but hopefully they'll actually make an answer. I haven't even thought of that, if they're actually going to make one for Xbox One.
I don't think so, dude.
Then maybe
I don't think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I actually need to get an X or a Series S or whatever it is. But anyway, that's, yeah, it's going to be exciting. Now, I'll let Matt talk a little bit about major season and major season in both golf and tennis. Obviously, I've watched the majors, but I haven't watched much PGA other than that. And I'm dang sure not going to watch LIV. So I'll let Matt talk a little bit about the season so far and kind of what we can expect from here. We got two majors gone and two majors left. So where are we at, Matt?
Yeah, well, that I wrote out the topic. I'm just going to read it basically on how I wrote it. I said, it's major season with two golf majors already over in the French Open and tennis rounding into the final days. Are people watching this / do people care? And does that matter? That's how I phrased the question. And again, I almost want to get your answer, Hayden. It seems like you kind of gave it away that you're not necessarily keeping up with a ton of this stuff. I will say, because I'm in it, obviously, you know, I'm just... Thankfully, I have a job that can just kind of I can have the scores up at the same time that I'm working at. So I'm obviously I'm super deep into all this stuff. I will say though, with the golf, it sucks. This time 3 years ago, I was graduating from college, and it was like the PGA was at the peak that it had ever been. All the best players were playing every single week. It was a true test to see who was going to win every tournament. Different guys would show up at different places. It's like the spring, summertime, you're going on your summer vacations. There's a golf event every single weekend. It's like the best thing to watch. And it's like, dude, I mean, this time it's like JJ Spawn is winning the players. And like Robert McIntyre from Scotland just won the Canadian Open last week. It's like, this isn't, Liv obviously ruined golf, and there was a time last year when this big announcement came through that they were gonna that the Liv Tour and the PGA Tour were gonna agree on some, they were gonna do some merger, and they were gonna bring all the players together and have some sort of, you know, some sort of joint venture or whatever. And I was super excited about that because I was like, yay, like golf is actually gonna be back. And it's just not like that's not happening anymore because like obviously everything's about money and people are greedy. And so, you know, everything's going to stay separate for now. So I guess that's kind of my main point with this is like, I'm even finding myself, like I keep up with who wins the tournaments every week, but even that isn't interesting enough for me to want to watch it. Like, obviously, yes, I'm watching the majors. I'm locked in because that's when all the Liv players are playing all the Liv and PGA Tour players are playing together. So yes, that's like my like recollection of what got me into golf was all the best players playing on at the same time. And it's just not happening anymore on a weekly basis. And the majors are the only ones that it are. And so to have it kind of 4 weekends out of the year to get really hyped for golf, like it's cool because it's like, I can pop in and I know all the players from when I really followed it, but you know, back in the day, a couple of years ago, but to just be like not excited about it on a weekly basis is something where I haven't really found myself in the last couple of years. And that's kind of made me kind of sad, Hayden. Like, I'm really getting my feelings about this, but yeah. But it is true. I mean, Hayden just kind of said too, like, he's not really paying attention. I mean, I remember even a couple of years ago, like, you know, the memorial's coming up this weekend at Muirfield Village. And it's like, we definitely watched like the Saturday and Sunday rounds. Like when I was home from college or something, yeah. You know, I think I just finished like my college semester and Hayden was at home still in high school. And like, we were locked in, like watching the memorial, and like Patrick Cantlay had like a 2-shot lead and he went to a playoff.
Yeah. With Jordan Spieth or something. I remember that. Yeah.
So yeah. And that's the type of stuff I'm talking about where it's like back then it was actually interesting because everybody was playing, but now it's just, I don't really know. And then on the tennis side of things, I'm super locked in cause I like it. And cause it's going on during the day. So it's like, because especially with the French Open, it's like 6 hours ahead. And so like they're playing at like 7 o'clock at night, which is 1 o'clock here. So it's just like a perfect sport for me to just like watch and follow all day long at work. Cause it's just like, I can have the scores up and keep track of it. But in terms of where we're at, obviously Roger Federer retired. Rafael Nadal had probably his last outing at the French Open, which he's won 14 of them and broken the record. And like, nobody's ever going to beat that record in terms of like single, like majors at a singular venue, really ever again. And he lost in straight sets to Zverev. So, so Djokovic is really the only person left in terms of the big three that's like still competing on a per tour scene basis. And even he was like hurt today. He got through the match. It was in five sets and he's probably going to lose because he's been in two straight 5-set matches. So it'll be interesting to see who wins on the women's side. Obviously it's Iga Swiatek and Aryna Sabalenka who are just killing it all the time. And so it's really cool to watch them because they always end up kind of getting into it at the last second with each other. Coco Gauff has been really good too. So I'm almost more excited about tennis rather than golf, which I never thought I would see myself saying that.
There you go.
Mostly too, because like I said, it takes place in a part of the world where it's like available for me to just kind of have open on my laptop, you know, during like work hours. But I think at the same time, it's almost like, and it's kind of like always going on like throughout the year, like golf is, yeah, there's a golf event every weekend, but it's Thursday through Sunday and that's it. Whereas tennis is pretty much like all day, every day. So, that's an interesting thing that I think I never really kind of saw that coming, but has been an interesting development, and it kind of sucks because golf is just like ruined now, but I guess we'll get through it.
Yeah, it definitely is for me. Like you're right. I mean, it was already hard enough to really lock in for every single PGA Tour event, you know, like Matt said, weekend after weekend, like just every single one you'd kind of have to keep track of. And it got a little bit tough to keep track, or not tough to keep track of, but it got a little bit tough to like really hone in on each event as it happened throughout all of the beginning of winter and spring. And then now it's just like so much harder when, right, you look at the leaderboard and you don't know any of the names in the top six. And it's like, this kind of sucks. So, yeah, I definitely have the or share the same sentiment with Matt regarding golf. It is still really fun to watch the majors. Like the Masters was great to watch this year, and it was, you know, yeah, it was just a really good time to watch both that and the PGA Championship so far. PGA Championship was also really good. But yeah, I mean, it's just not nearly as fun to watch as it used to be. And I don't know how long this live stuff is going to last, but like Matt said, we're just gonna have to kind of trudge through it. I'm gonna try to get into more tennis too, though. Matt's kind of gotten me hyped with that. I haven't watched any tennis this year, really, but I'm gonna try to keep myself updated as much as possible. But we had one more rundown topic, but we're just gonna kind of leave that because we're getting a little bit late on time here, and also it's not really that important. So with that being said, I'm going to leave you all with that. Thank you guys for listening to our first episode back in about 5 months. It's going to be a little bit, you know, a little bit probably rocky in terms of like the quality of our episodes here, getting our footing back. But Matt's practicing his golf swing here, so we're getting back into the swing of things, and hopefully we will have another episode out for you guys within the week. That's going to be the goal, like Matt said, and like I said at the beginning. Gonna try to do one, at least one per week, if not more, if we can get to that point. And NCAA Doomsday Series continuation is hopefully gonna happen sometime in July. So have that to look forward to as well. But this month of June is just gonna kind of be getting our footing back, getting back into the routine of doing the podcast. So be ready for some summer madness. And we appreciate you guys for listening. We will see you guys in less than a week, hopefully. Thank you, guys.